content of this program. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine, as usual, is bordered in red with a narrow inner border of white. Time, in large block lettering, appears in a bluish-gray. Large print superimposed upon a turquoise-blue background. The turquoise-blue background features concentric circles from the outside of the cover to the dot on the inside. It's in white. And kneeling over this spiral effect, it's not a spiral because there are concentric circles in white over turquoise, is what looks like the back of a person with a large brimmed white picture hat in shadow. So the clothing looks bluish white. There are some flip-flops or beach sandals next to this person. It's a caricature. It's not a photograph. The left hand and the index finger is pointing toward that center circle, almost dot of those concentric circles. And the person, the caricature person, is kneeling on what looks like a dock. It has planks in it, and it's orange. It looks like an orange tablet, actually. How to Do More Good is the title on this cover page by Naina Vajikal, and we may read that article. It's quite long, so I may read it, and I may abbreviate it, or I may not, because we're going to start with For the Record. Seven articles, short. 1874, the last time a swimmer was attacked by a shark in UK waters until July 28, when a snorkeler reported being bitten off the coast of southwest England. It's time for a new international convention that accepts the war on drugs has failed, by Gustavo Petro, Colombian president, at his swearing in August 7. I have never wanted to have to choose between tennis and a family. I don't think it's fair, said Serena Williams, announcing she plans to retire from tennis, in part so she can have another child, in Vogue, August 9. I love snakes. I hate that we have to do this, said Amy Siwe, or Siva, S-I-E-W-E, one of 850 professional snake hunters who traveled to the Everglades to kill invasive Burmese pythons as part of the Florida Python Challenge, August 5, stated to CNN. 47% increase in the retail price of eggs in July from a year earlier, according to an August 9 report by analytics firm Information Resources, Inc. I would wonder if that's also a 47% decline in laying hens since last July. 72. The number of looted artifacts, London's Horniman Museum and Gardens said August 7 that it will return to Nigeria after more than a century. You know what perjury is, right? Said Mark Bankston, a lawyer for the parents of Sandy Hook school shooting victim Jesse Lewis, to conspiracy theorist Alex Jones at a defamation trial August 3, after Jones's lawyers accidentally turned over the entire contents of the InfoWars founder's phone. Its contents contradicted Jones's previous statements about his claims that Sandy Hook shooting was a hoax. Nation, Why Americans May Soon See Lower Drug Costs by Abigail Abrams. At press time, and this was dated, did I tell you the date of this magazine? August 22/August 29, 2022. At press time, Democrats were poised to enact a sweeping health care achievement that will address one of the country's most intractable problems, high prescription drug costs. The Inflation Reduction Act would allow Medicare for the first time to negotiate with drug makers for lower prescription drug prices. This could be life-changing for older Americans, saving some thousands of dollars a year. The package would also cap out-of-pocket costs that seniors pay for medication at $2,000 annually and guarantee they have access to vaccines for free. It would require pharmaceutical companies to pay rebates if their drug prices rise faster than inflation, and it would extend the expanded subsidies that 13 million Americans got during the pandemic to buy health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, ACA. All told, it would be the biggest change to health care since the ACA was passed in 2010. Here is how the health care pieces of the bill would affect Americans. The package would empower the federal government to negotiate prices for certain expensive medications that seniors get at doctor's offices or pharmacies, a goal decades in the making. Starting in 2026, Medicare could negotiate the prices of 10 drugs. That would increase to 15 drugs in 2027 and 2028, then 20 drugs in 2029. While it is not yet clear which drugs would be negotiated and precisely how many Americans would be helped, the provision would curtail costs and deliver significant savings for Medicare over time, according to the Congressional Budget Office, CBO. Another piece of the bill would prevent older Americans and those with disabilities from paying more than $2,000 a year for medications they buy at a pharmacy. Right now, Medicare beneficiaries have no out-of-pocket maximum for drug costs. Once they reach $7,050 in a year, they pay 5% of subsequent costs. Under the new bill, they would not pay any costs for medications once they reach $2,000 in a year. The bill would also get rid of cost sharing for adult vaccines covered under Medicare Part D, another provision that experts say would help seniors get the treatment they need. The bill would require drug makers to pay rebates if their medication prices rise faster than inflation. Prescription drug prices have increased sometimes at 2 to 3 times the rate of inflation, according to Glenn Fuchs, Director of Healthcare Access and Affordability at AARP. The rebates would be limited to those on Medicare. The pharmaceutical industry argues the changes would hurt the development of new drugs, but the CBO found changes in the bill would lead to 15 fewer drugs reaching the market over the next 30 years, or about 1% of an estimated 1,300 in that time. Curbing insulin costs. The bill would cap the price of insulin at $35 per month for Medicare patients, one in three of whom has diabetes. Medicare patients using insulin spend an average of $54 per prescription in 2020, according to the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation, a burden for people on fixed incomes. The bill would extend the beefed-up subsidies for low- and middle-income Americans buying insurance under the ACA. The expanded pandemic subsidies were set to expire at the end of this year. Now they would last through 2025. The brief news, three news ticker events here. Emmett Till accuser not indicted. A Mississippi grand jury declined to indict Carolyn Bryant Donham, the white woman whose accusations incited the lynching of Emmett Till almost 70 years ago, despite the recent discovery of an unserved 1955 arrest warrant for her over the black teen's kidnapping. California accuses Tesla of false advertising. The California Department of Motor Vehicles has accused Tesla of falsely claiming in advertisements that its driver assist technology made vehicles fully autonomous. Regulators say the names of the features, autopilot and full self-driving, are themselves misleading. Inflation hits white families less hard. Inflation is causing serious financial problems for the majority of Native American, Black, and Latino households, according to a national poll released August 8 from NPR. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and Harvard. Nearly 70% of Native families and nearly 60% of Black and Latino respondents said rising prices have led to trouble paying bills, compared with 38% of white families. Good question. Did Pelosi's trip make Taiwan less secure? By Charlie Campbell. And like that, she was gone. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi departed Taiwan August 3 after a lightning visit that included addressing the island's parliament, visiting its National Human Rights Museum, and holding a televised meeting with President Tsai Ing-wen. Pelosi's the most senior politician to visit Taiwan in a quarter century, but Beijing's reaction to the trip, it considers the self-ruling island its sovereign territory and fiercely opposed the visit, was both swift and unprecedented. Within hours of Pelosi's departure, China began several days of live fire drills and missile tests that encircled Taiwan. The maneuvers are the largest in recent memory and impeded commercial shipping and flights to the island. Taiwan's foreign minister accused Beijing of using the drills as a pretext for taking over the Taiwan Strait, which separates the island from mainland China. Chinese state media said the drills involved over 100 warplanes and more than 10 destroyers and frigates. Some of the missiles flew over Taiwan, a worrying first, while others landed in Japanese waters. On Taiwan, whether Pelosi's visit was a good idea remains a point of division. On one side of Taiwan's legislative building, a group held up banners welcoming her to the Republic of Taiwan in a nod to their aspirations of formal independence. Across the way, pro-Beijing demonstrators brandished placards denouncing the 82-year-old as an arsonist meddling in China's internal affairs. For many, strong U.S. support is important as the gap between China's and Taiwan's conventional military power continues to widen. Yet Taiwanese are largely ambivalent about both these symbolic diplomatic visits and China's furious reaction to them. The Taiwanese are largely over it, says Sung Wen-ti, a Taipei-based scholar for the Australian National University. They've been living under the same threat for about a quarter century. Still, Pelosi's visit came days after China's strongman, Xi Jinping, warned President Joe Biden against playing with fire over the island. And beyond the heightened risk of confrontation between the nuclear-armed superpowers, the trip could undermine the U.S. policy of strategic ambiguity over whether it would defend the island in an event of an attack. This approach, crafted in 1979 after the U.S. cut off formal ties with Taipei, is intended to avoid riling Beijing and discourage Taiwan from needlessly poking the dragon. Over the past year, however, Biden's twice said he would defend the island from China, coming dangerously close to violating this decades-old policy. As for what exactly Pelosi left behind, we can only wait and watch, but nobody gains from any of it, says Shelley Rigger, a professor of political science at Davidson College in North Carolina, and author of Why Taiwan Matters, The Cost to U.S.-China Relations and Taiwan Security is Really High. From the bulletin, Breonna Taylor's family sees justice in federal charges by Josiah Bates. The August 4 arrest on federal charges of four Louisville, Kentucky police officers involved in the raid that killed Breonna Taylor was understood by her family and supporters as the beginning of justice they thought had been denied. Officers raided Taylor's home using a no-knock warrant in March 2020 and killed her after her boyfriend, believing they were intruders, fired toward them. I have waited 874 days for today, said Tamika Palmer, Taylor's mother. A federal grand jury in Louisville charged officers lied both before and after the raid, falsifying an affidavit to get the warrant. Breonna Taylor should be alive today, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland said in announcing charges that former Detective Joshua Janes and Sergeant Kyle Meany had willingly violated Taylor's civil rights under color of law. A third officer, Detective Kelly Goodlett, was charged with conspiracy. The fourth officer, Brett Hankinson, was charged with two counts of violating the rights of Taylor and her boyfriend through unconstitutionally excessive force by firing 10 shots through a covered window and a covered glass door. Hankinson was the only officer to face state charges, for which he was acquitted in March. If convicted of federal charges, Janes, Meany, and Hankinson face sentences of up to life in federal prison. The Justice Department has long served as a selective backstop in local police shootings, and the indictments were cited by observers who alleged Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron had failed to present all the evidence in the case prepared by the Commonwealth. I hope we will finally use these cases to look at the system, says Sadiqa Reynolds of the Louisville Urban League, and the corruption within the system. There's a photo here, rather colorful. A whole bunch of people are encircling a table that is filled with papers. There are a few covered plastic boxes secured with, like, some kind of plastic ties next to the table. There are people riffling through the papers. Most of these people are wearing hoodies and long pants, and some have stocking caps, and some have baseball caps, and they're in a rather bare-looking room, with the exception of the table filled with papers and the plastic boxes tied securely. The floor looks like gray concrete, and the walls also look like concrete, but they're painted kind of a light orange tan. The caption reads, "Test for Democracy. Kenyans went to the polls August 9 to replace outgoing President Uhuru Kenyatta following a tightly contested election campaign in which rising living costs and high unemployment in the East African nation dominated discussion. Results were still being counted as time went to press August 10, with little separating the two leading candidates, Raila Odinga, who's making his fifth bid for the job, and William Ruto, Kenyatta's deputy president." More news ticker. Three items here. BTS could get military exemptions. Boy band BTS might still be able to perform overseas while serving in the military, South Korea's defense minister said August 1. Parliament is also debating a bill to shorten military service, which is compulsory for South Korean men ages 18 to 28, from 18 months to 3 weeks for K-pop stars. Iranian charged in plot to kill Bolton. The U.S. Justice Department charged a member of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps with plotting to assassinate former National Security Advisor John Bolton, offering $300,000 for the murder, allegedly in retaliation for the U.S. drone strike that killed Iranian Commander Qasem Soleimani in 2020. UK energy cost crisis to worsen. Annual UK energy bills are to surge to £4,266, in other words, $5,157 in January, an increase of more than 300% from 2021, a consultancy predicted August 8. Pressures mounting for enhanced state support, which lags behind the measures introduced by other European countries amid warnings of widening poverty. Economy. Some CEOs are cutting staff, even as the job market booms, by Alana Samuels. In many ways, the U.S. economy looks very strong, having added 528,000 jobs in July, according to official figures published August 5, almost double what analysts had expected. The unemployment rate dropped to 3.5%. It has not been lower in half a century. And consumers are still opening their wallets. Retail spending in July increased 11.2% over the previous year, according to the MasterCard Spending Pulse, which measures in-store and online retail sales across all forms of payment. Yet some CEOs are cutting jobs based on feelings of doom and gloom, even though their companies are thriving, actions that could negatively affect consumer sentiment. Earlier this summer, Elon Musk reportedly emailed colleagues at his electric vehicle company Tesla that he had a super bad feeling about the economy and that he planned to cut staff at Tesla by 10%, a plan he later executed. The next month, Musk said during an earnings call that the second quarter of 2022 was one of the strongest quarters of our history, and that Tesla had the potential for a record-breaking second half of the year. Meanwhile, Oracle made cuts across the company despite reporting revenues were up 5% and that the company finds itself in position to deliver stellar revenue growth over the next several quarters. Microsoft laid off around 1,000 people and then reported in late July profit rose 2%. Even Ford, which said in late July its net income rose 19% and that consumers are buying products as quickly as the company can make them, is planning to cut thousands of workers in the coming weeks. The debate over whether the U.S. is in a recession is ongoing, but if a downturn does hit, CEOs, not consumers, might stand to shoulder most of the blame after conducting widespread layoffs, even as their companies perform well. Some may be incurring higher staff costs to attract talent. Hourly earnings are up 5.2% from 2021. But recent layoffs and hiring freezes are unusual because they're anticipatory rather than reactionary. I do believe only the paranoid survive, Spotify's Daniel Elk said in late July, while announcing the company would proactively reduce hiring by 25%. And we're preparing as if things could get worse. But it's hard to be anything but optimistic, given what I am currently seeing. The company added 5 million more users than anticipated last quarter. It posted 23% revenue growth. For much of the past century, companies did not lay off workers till they were in trouble and needed to cut costs, says Matthew Bidwell, a professor of management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Then in the 1990s, even profitable companies started to downsize. They got comfortable with, we're making money, but we can be making even more money, he says. In 1979, the year before a new capitalism focused on efficiency became popular in the U.S., fewer than 5% of Fortune 500 companies announced layoffs. During the Great Recession and its aftermath, 65% did. Hiring and firing has become a way for CEOs to signal they're strong, decisive leaders taking bold action, Bidwell says, even though those decisions might fly in the face of what is best for the company or the wider economy. Layoffs can play a role in how the economy is perceived, which may have a knock-on effect elsewhere. American households may cut back on spending in anticipation of bad times, even if their finances are doing well, and laid-off workers will behave cautiously until they find new jobs. Research shows layoffs are almost always bad for a company, says Sandra J. Sucker, a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School. Workers who are not laid off will start looking around for other jobs because they feel uneasy about their employer's prospects. Those who are laid off will find jobs at competitors and help them innovate. Downsizing a workforce by 1% can lead to a 31% increase in voluntary turnover, according to one study. Another study found that after a layoff, survivors at the companies experienced a 41% decline in job satisfaction. The fact that these turn out to be self-defeating decisions makes this a particularly bad strategy, Sucker says. These CEOs may be spooked by what is going on, but that does not mean they're smart. It means they need to regulate their anxiety. Society, how to do the most good. A growing movement argues we should care about people thousands of miles away and millions of years in the future, by Naina Bajikal, Oxford, UK, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein, New York. This lengthy article may be abbreviated. 13 years ago, William McCaskill found himself standing in the aisle of a grocery store, agonizing over which breakfast cereal to buy. If he switched to a cheaper brand for a year, could he put aside enough money to save someone's life? It was not the first time he had been gripped by this kind of angst. His life has often felt like a series of difficult choices. Should he donate even more money to charity? Should he quit academia and work in politics, even if he hated it, in the hopes of having a greater social impact? What if he moved to a different city? Could he do more to help others elsewhere? For anyone enjoying a comfortable life in a world of horrifying inequality, examining your choices closely might spark similar questions. For McCaskill, a 35-year-old Scottish philosopher who co-founded a movement dedicated to doing the most good possible, the stakes of even mundane decisions can feel especially high. Yet when we meet on a sunny July afternoon in Oxford, he seems to have found a way to carry that load. In fact, for a man who spent the past few years thinking about how humanity might permanently derail its future, he is surprisingly cheerful. He just returned from a week of surfing with his partner, Holly Morgan, on the south coast of England. After years of suffering from depression and anxiety, he now prioritizes sleep, exercise, and meditation. He enjoys swimming outdoors, playing the saxophone, and holding fire raves in fields with friends, dancing around a bonfire to house music until the early hours. There are many things in my life I care about for intrinsic reasons, he says. Not because I've done some 12-dimensional maths about how it contributes to the greater good. The greater good has been the focus of his work for more than a decade, since he helped start the Effective Altruism, EA, movement, which aims to use evidence and reason to find the best ways of helping others and to put those findings into practice. EA holds we should value all lives equally and act on that basis. It is the antithesis of the old do-gooder's credo, think global, act local. His new book, What We Owe the Future, argues we should expand the moral circle even further. if we care about people thousands of miles away, we should care about people thousands or even millions of years in the future. The book, which has been praised by the likes of Stephen Fry and Elon Musk, makes the case for long-termism, the view that positively influencing the long-term future, not just this generation or the next, but the potentially trillions of people still to come, is a key moral priority of our time. Through analyzing the risks of climate change, man-made pathogens, nuclear weapons, and advanced artificial intelligence, McCaskill has come to believe we are living at a pivotal moment in human history, one where the fate of the world depends significantly on the choices we make in our lifetimes. Stopping for a second here, first of all, to spell the name of William McCaskill, M-A-C-A-S-K-I-L-L. And here's a photo with a caption of Associate Philosophy Professor William McCaskill at his Oxford office, July 14. It's a young-looking man with longish, but not definitely not shoulder-length, brown hair, dark-rimmed glasses, a pale complexion, slightly smiling at the camera, wearing a black V-neck t-shirt and dark-colored, I would say dark khaki to charcoal gray, Bermuda shorts, black shoes and socks, and he's seated in a really comfortable-looking lounge chair with ottoman, both modernistic in design, in a pale blue-gray. Behind him are bookshelves, not really too crowded, a couple of waste baskets, A chandelier, it's not fancy, again, it's modernistic in tan and white, a few green plants, and I don't know, one is a philodendron, but I don't know if they're real or fake. Moving on now with other aspects of the article. For many years, EA, which is both a research field and a real-life community, drew a small group of moral philosophers, nonprofit researchers, Bay Area rationalists, and altruistically inclined students. Now their ideas are increasingly taking off outside of those circles. More than 7,000 people have signed a pledge to give away at least 10% of their income to the kinds of high-impact charities recommended by, for example, GiveWell, which started in 2007 in New York City to evaluate charities based on cost-effectiveness. There are more than 200 EA chapters around the world, from Nigeria to India to Mexico. This year, approximately 6,000 individuals will attend conferences in cities including Prague, Singapore, and San Francisco, where EA, with its data-driven approach to doing good, has found a particularly receptive audience. EAs, as members of this movement call themselves, are working in government, advising on policy, and running for office. The expansion has been fueled by a substantial rise in donations. In 2021, EA-aligned foundations distributed more than $600 million in publicly listed grants, roughly quadruple what they gave 5 years earlier. While this is a minute fraction of global philanthropy and only 0.1% of U.S. giving, which amounted to $485 billion the same year, the movement is growing and has the support of a new generation of young philanthropists planning to funnel their fortunes into EA causes. The vast majority of EA's newfound wealth comes from two tech billionaires, Dustin Moskovitz and Sam Bankman-Fried. Open Philanthropy, which is primarily funded by the Facebook and Asana co-founder Moskovitz and his wife Carrie Tuna, distributed more than $440 million in grants in 2021, a third of which went to global health and development, 28% to long-termist interventions such as biosecurity and EA community growth, 18% to animal welfare, and the rest to research in areas such as economic policy and criminal justice reform. 4 months after launching in February this year, the FTX Future Fund had committed more than $130 million in grants, mostly to long-termist causes. The money comes from Bankman-Fried, the CEO of cryptocurrency exchange FTX, who was inspired to pursue a high-earning career after meeting McCaskill in 2012. Bloomberg estimates Bankman-Fried's net worth at $12.8 billion, down because of this year's crypto market crash, and Moskovitz's at $13.8 billion. Both have committed to giving away most of their wealth, with EA-aligned organizations as the tributaries. Between them, that is more than $26 billion. That far surpasses the endowments of two of America's oldest private foundations, the Ford Foundation, $16 billion, and the Rockefeller Foundation, $6.3 billion. Like those foundations, Open Philanthropy and the Future Fund function as grant makers for projects, nonprofits, and individuals they deem high impact. Despite all this growth, McCaskill still worries he is not doing enough. Every year, millions of people die from easily preventable diseases. Millions more are oppressed and abused. Hundreds of millions go hungry. On top of that, some 80 billion land animals are killed for food every year. That's just a place to be, he says. As he sees it, pure moral philosophy leads to the conclusion that the correct thing, at least for someone with his privileges in a wealthy country, is to sacrifice everything you could for the greater good. The question is, he says, how do I manage my life such that even though I believe that at the fundamental level, I do not go completely insane? The EA movement has proved remarkably expansive, allowing those who might be inclined toward radical individualism to work alongside the more collectively minded. But for it to deliver on its aim, to improve as many lives as possible, it needs to help answer an impossible question. How much comfort should we be willing to trade for potentially enormous gains to society? Many of the people who helped give rise to EA felt compelled to do good from a young age. At 11, Neil Bowerman tried to encourage his London classmates to carpool to help combat climate change. As a 13-year-old in suburban Richmond, Virginia, Julia Wise began giving away her allowance. The summer before his senior year at Stanford, Alexander Berger signed up to donate a kidney to a stranger. 16-year-old Benjamin Todd conducted an audit to show his school could reduce carbon emissions. In response, the school started an organic garden. That was not really what I had in mind, he says now, laughing. I'm currently abridging this article considerably. I'm on the last page where you will hear the last column and a fourth. On McCaskill's desk in Oxford are portraits of three people. Mosey, M-O-Z-I, the ancient Chinese moral philosopher who taught morality should involve equal, impartial concern for all. Benjamin Lay, the Anglo-American Quaker who was a prominent early opponent of slavery. And Irena Sendler, the Polish humanitarian who rescued Jews during the Second World War. Looking at them reminds him of the long path from these moral pioneers to the widespread uptake of their ideas. The first public protest against African American slavery was the 1688 German town Quaker petition. Slavery was only abolished in the British Empire in 1833. Decades later in the U.S., not until 1962 in Saudi Arabia. History encourages McCaskill to favor gradual progress over revolution. Abolition, he says, is maybe the single best moral change ever. It's certainly up there with feminism, and they're extremely incremental. They do not seem that way because we enormously shrink the past, but it's almost 300 years we are talking about. As McCaskill works to advocate for the generations to come, he tries to keep in mind how ideas play out over decades and centuries. In What We Owe the Future, McCaskill argues, a flourishing future is not fantasy. It may not be likely, but it is possible. It is a future that, with enough patience and wisdom, our descendants could actually build, if we pave the way for them, he writes. Part of that task requires cultivating imaginative compassion. At the end of the hardback edition of McCaskill's new book, a QR code takes you to a short story, Afterwards, dedicated to his girlfriend, Holly. Set thousands of years in the future in a utopia, meaning a good place, and that's spelled E-U-T-O-P-I-A, whereas utopia, U-T-O-P-I-A, means no place. There is a scene where a character describes how she has been reading some history. She's incredulous that people once traveled around in trains underground, crammed together, making one another sick, and they would do it every day, and they would hate it, but they would keep doing it because they had to, just to have a life that was barely good at all, and they hardly thought about how much better life could be. I find this surprisingly moving. If I think about my ancestors, even 200 years ago, they would never have been able to picture my life now. It is no surprise it's hard for me to imagine a future that is much better than what McCaskill calls a global Scandinavia, where everyone has about as good a life as the most well-off people alive today have. We could really make things very good in the future, he tells me. Imagine your very best days. You could have a life that is as good as that, 100 times over, 1,000 times over. In the days that follow, I find myself thinking of that conversation, of the moments in my life that have shimmered with beauty and joy and love and laughter, and the stability and safety that made those moments more possible. I think of all the people alive right now who deserve to have such moments, and all the lives still to come that could be so much better and richer in meaning, or so much worse. If that depends upon what we all do in the next few decades, I do not know exactly how to help ensure our actions are for the better. But if the future could be as vast and good as McCaskill thinks, it seems worth trying. 8 questions here by Kate with a C, Matthews with 2 T's. Today it's Neil Gaiman, G-A-I-M-A-N, the prolific author on a new Netflix adaptation of his classic comic, The Upside of Nightmares and the Practical Uses of Fantasy. A photo here of Gaiman. He has kind of tousled-looking hair, but in an organized way. It comes down low upon his brow, hitting the top of his dark-framed glasses. It's cut neatly, symmetrically, behind his ears, down to the top of his black T-shirt or shirt collar. I should say he's neither laughing nor not laughing at the camera. It's a black and white photo, so I can't provide any more coloration to the description. Questions and answers in this format. What do you say to people who look at The Sandman and do not see literature? Answer. I like the fact that comics are still a gutter medium because there's always life in the gutter. It does not matter to me if people think Sandman is literature. What I care about is that people read it and it matters to them. Question. It has been more than 30 years since you started writing The Sandman. What was it like to revisit? Answer. It felt like we were doing something that was literally impossible. I had spent 30 years waiting for somebody to make a bad Sandman film and just hoping that if I was really lucky, maybe it would not be bad. Was there anything that upon rereading you were excited to update? Answer, mostly going through the old comics reminded us the extent to which Sandman had been rather ahead of its time. back when nobody commented on the fact that it was filled with gay characters, trans characters, black characters, we actually had gone and made something that felt pretty much of its time. Question, in one of the Sandman series later episode, there is a line about how a nightmare's purpose is to reveal a dreamer's fears so they may face them. What did you learn from your nightmares? Answer, I have learned to trust my dreams and nightmares. When I was a kid, I had terrible nightmares. When I was writing Sandman, they continued. But whenever I would get a nightmare, I would wake up thrilled and immediately jot it down and go, whoa, I can use that. The nightmares went away. My theory was that whoever was giving me them was so disappointed by my reaction that they just couldn't be bothered anymore. The character of Death, capitalized, offers some of the warmest moments in the show. What informed your creation of her? Answer, I loved the idea of a death that was warm, a death that you would like to meet. I thought, that's the death I'd like. When it's my turn to go, there'd just be somebody lovely there saying, oh, I'm so sorry. You should have looked both ways before crossing that street. That was the death I wanted. Question, what does fantasy offer in times like these, full of so many real-world crises? Answer, fantasy sends us back to our lives with a different point of view. Politics makes an awful lot more sense if you read George R.R. Martin's Game of Thrones books. You realize politicians are people, and they are acting on their own motivations. Sometimes those motivations are beneficial, and often it is going to be your village burned. On a micro level, I have spent 34 years with people coming up to me and saying, your character, Death, in Sandman got me through the death of my loved one. The fact that fantasy can help shoulder that burden is huge. Question, despite the many adaptations of your work, including of fan favorite novels Good Omens and American Gods, you have a reputation for trying to steer Hollywood away from your work. Why? Answer, from the age of 24 to 27, I was a film critic, and I saw a lot of bad films. I could not see the point in making bad films. I did not want to make things that were less than they could have been. Sometimes the chances you take pay off, and sometimes they do not. Question, what would you tell your 28-year-old self who published the first issues of The Sandman? Answer, oh, I wouldn't tell him anything. The thing that kept him doing the impossible was a combination of terror and the knowledge that if he did not do this thing, it would not happen. If I went back in time and said, hey, 30 years from now it will be in print and we're going to make the most amazing television series of it, he would relax and stop working. In order to get where we are, I need him to be hungry and terrified. Under the heading World Far From Home, 1 year after the fall of Kabul, Afghan women are trying to build new lives abroad. This story was produced in partnership with the Pulitzer Center and in collaboration with Rukhshana Media, an Afghan women's media organization. And I am not seeing a person to cite for the writing. Here it must be. Amy Ferris Rotman and Zara Joya. This may be abbreviated also. When the Taliban walked into the capital of Afghanistan, August 15, 2021, America's longest war came to an end. The vacuum left by the exit of U.S. troops forced tens of thousands of Afghans to flee. Some were evacuated by Western nations. Others escaped on foot. For many Afghan women, the Taliban takeover spelled the end of the freedoms they had enjoyed for two decades. 1 year on, thousands of women are scattered across the world. For this project, a global team of female journalists and photographers spent time with eight individuals who are building new lives from the beaches of Florida, to the suburbs of Dublin. Starting anew has not been easy. They ache for their homeland and their loved ones, unsure when they will see them again beyond their cell phone screens. At night, they often return to Afghanistan in their dreams. They're wrestling with new identities, spending their days learning new languages, and exchanging their Afghan Air Force uniforms for restaurant aprons. Over the past 20 years, U.S. officials often defended the war as an effort to improve the lives of Afghan women and girls. There were real successes. Around half of Afghan girls, some 4 million children, entered elementary school, compared with almost none 2 decades earlier. Women filled university hallways, joined the medical profession, traveled freely across the country, entered nearly every aspect of public life, becoming lawmakers, judges, governors, police officers. An all-female robotics team garnered global fame. Afghan female athletes became Olympians. In a country where nearly two-thirds of the population is under 25 years old, members of Afghanistan's young generation particularly flourished during the U.S. and NATO's war against the Taliban, which had ruled the country in the late 1990s before being ousted by U.S.-backed Afghan forces in 2001. The international community encouraged women to chase their dreams, be emboldened by the end of the repressive rule many of those same women had known as children. When the final U.S. troops withdrew in a chaotic exit last summer, Afghan women saw their hard-won gains evaporate overnight. Despite promising to honor women's rights within Islam, the Taliban has intensified its crackdowns, just as Afghan activists had long warned. The Taliban has banned high school for girls, placed restrictions on women working and traveling abroad, ordered that women stay at home, and that if they must go out, they cover their entire body and face except for their eyes. The regime has closed almost all shelters for women fleeing violence, and domestic violence is now sharply on the rise. It disbanded the Ministry for Women's Affairs and suppressed women's demonstrations. The number of child marriages is surging, and women are increasingly committing suicide. The Afghan women who managed to get out are the lucky ones, but they feel betrayed by a world that promised to stand by them. They mourn the loss of freedoms that reverberates across their nation and several generations. These are women who once were full of optimism about the future of their country. They joined Afghanistan's security forces or became educators, artists, and activists. Now they are free and safe, but they're also far from the homes they love and the futures they deserve. Some of these people include Najiba Ibrahimi Salpalo, Batu al-Haidari Rome, Hasina Najibi, and Rahana Rahimi, Fort Myers, Florida. I will read at least part of their story. Afghan Air Force pilots Hasina Najibi and Rahana Rahimi met last year when they attended an aviation training in Dubai. The two women, who are both 25, immediately clicked and became close friends. They shared a passion for flying, and both had to fight to earn that right. Najibi, an ethnic Pashtun, would go to work disguised in large sunglasses, worried her relatives and neighbors would discover she was a pilot. Rahimi often faced discrimination in the armed forces for belonging to the Hazara community. By the way, Faranaz Foratan wrote this particular item. They were preparing to return from Dubai when the Taliban captured Kabul. Worried that the Taliban would take revenge on their families if they were discovered, they told their families to burn the uniforms they had left at home, as well as their pilot IDs and diplomas. Najibi watched on a video call as her mother set her uniform alight. "All my dreams were on fire," she says, "and I was just watching." Now, living together in the heat of southern Florida, the women wait tables in a strip mall. In the evenings, they put a rug under the tree near their apartment. They drink green tea and talk about their lives back in Afghanistan and their biggest dream, to return to the skies. Question, what has surprised you about where you live now? Answers, Najibi, the streets, the people, the food, even the trees, nothing is familiar here. Rahimi, how far we are from home. In the early days, Hasina and I would look at the map of the world from time to time. We would look at America and then Afghanistan, and we would get a scary feeling of being so far from our home. Question, when you think of Afghanistan's future, what comes to mind? Rahimi, I think about Afghan women and how they should not be forgotten. They lost everything they had, their lives, their rights, their dreams, are now being held hostage. Sometimes I feel the situation's not going to last. I think one day Afghanistan will be liberated and we will return to our country. How can a regime that ignores half of society survive? Where do you see yourself 1 year from now? Najibi, all I dream of is returning to my studies. I hope by this time next year I will be closer to my goal. Rahimi, I lost my life, but I won't lose my hope. I'm determined to find a way back into my profession. This is the dream that keeps me alive. Even though I sometimes feel exhausted, I tell myself I will find a way back in Afghanistan. My family and even my teachers at times would tell me piloting is not for me. I always felt the discrimination, but I succeeded there. I am sure I can succeed again. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.